we should all sit down and so that we can continue now with our next lecturer, who is Laura Nasrallah from Harvard Divinity School, where she is teaching New Testament and Early Christianity. Her specific research focus is to read early Christian literature in tandem with archaeology and with the archaeological remains of the Roman world. Results of this approach can be found, for example, in her book on Thessaloniki, From Roman to Early Christian Thessaloniki, Studies in Religion and Archaeology, or in another book on Christian responses to Roman art and architecture, both from 2010. Professor Nasrallah is currently working on a book on archaeology and the letters of Paul, and now she will give us some insights in this field in her lecture with the title Public Letters, Early Christian Letters and Roman Epigraphic Evidence. Please.
Thank you for this invitation. It's wonderful to make new friends and to see old ones in this context. Ta-Nehisi Coates' 2015 book, Between the World and Me, begins this way. Son, last Sunday, the host of a popular news show asked me what it meant to lose my body. Coates' meditation on Black identity in the United States comes in the form of a letter to his son. In this form and in this context, Coates echoes James Baldwin's December 1962 piece for the magazine The Progressive, revised for publication in The Fire Next Time. It is titled My Dungeon Shook, Letter to My Nephew on the 100th Anniversary of the Emancipation. This piece begins, Dear James, I have begun this letter 5 times and torn it up 5 times. I keep seeing your face, which is also the face of your brother, your father and my brother. I know what the world has done to my brother and how narrowly he survived it, and I know which is much worse, and this is the crime of which I accuse my country and my countrymen, and for which neither I nor time nor history will ever forgive them, that they have destroyed and are destroying hundreds of thousands of lives and do not know it and do not want to know it. I begin with these two examples because they have helped me to think about the power of the epistolary form deployed in a public setting, published. Coates and Baldwin before him are not the first to write open letters and publish them, but they may be two of the most compelling writers who recently offer us glimpses of the power of the public display of what seems to be private correspondence. Indeed, they offer a putatively private critique of power, engagement with politics, and an assertion of authority on their own. Coates and Baldwin on the one hand and early Christian letters on the other prompt us to consider what is the function of publishing letters and what is the force of direct address when its readers or hearers are not those to whom the address is offered. What cultural context can help to explain the early Christian practice of collecting and publishing letters not originally addressed to them, of seeing themselves as the ecclesiae that had been addressed long ago, of understanding the letters to be a relevant archive for themselves? I will argue that one important context for the collecting and disseminating, we could say publication of early Christian letters, is to think about the publication of letters in the civic centers of the Roman period, that is, about the formation of very public archives. Let me pause for a moment and explain what my presentation is not, given the variety and excellence and perhaps overabundance of study of the letters of Paul in particular and early Christian letter writing more generally. First, my paper does not have to do with questions of how these original letters were written and circulated with the aid of slave or freedmen carriers, with the help of scribes who were perhaps slaves. I focus instead on the larger cultural context of the collection and publication of letters in the second century CE and following. Second, my paper does not here address some of the other important contexts for understanding the rewriting, invention, and grouping of the Pauline letters in particular in the second century and beyond. I've argued elsewhere, for instance, that one important context for understanding Paul's letters broadly conceived and early Christian letters broadly conceived is that of epistolary narrative, as Rosenmeier has termed it. She argues that, especially in the second century CE and following, letter collections were invented which were putatively written by a famous person, say Themistocles or Plato. These letters allow the reader to trace out the life of great men through the relative intimacy and attendant fascination of the epistolary form. This trend helps to explain the collection of Paul's letters and the ways in which texts like the pastoral epistles, which claim to be by Paul but are not, on the one hand, and the production of other later fictive letters, such as those between Paul and Seneca, on the other, letters that contain funny critiques, such as Seneca's suggestion that Paul should work on his Latin. The Christian theological imaginary involved the production of other worlds, alternate possible universes, letters that could have been written. There has been, over the last 30 years, excellent work on letter writing in early Christianity, inspired perhaps by Deisman's famous characterization of Paul's writings as letters, not epistles, that is, as more authentic, more spontaneous, and heartfelt writings compared to the literary productions of contemporaneous Roman elites like Cicero, say. Paul's letters, therefore, were to be best explored in the context of documentary papyri and ostraca. After Stan Stauer's letter writing in Greco-Roman antiquity, we have had more recent forays into the topic. Increasing attention has been paid to the mechanics of letter writing and the roles of slaves in the network of letter transmission. Lutz Döring has worked to put Paul's letters into the context of Jewish letter writing. Professor Liu has demonstrated the importance of early Christian letters in the Christian canon and in early Christian practice on the one hand, and their cultural context amid other forms of letter writing in antiquity on the other. And her recent presidential address to the SNTS helpfully thinks about the early Christian letters in the context of spaces, real and imagined, and the networks of antiquity. In this scholarly context, my paper focuses on an underutilized, who would have thought it possible in New Testament studies, underutilized context for understanding early Christian letter writing, epigraphic evidence of letters found in civic spaces. This paper considers the phenomenon of publicly displayed letters in civic spaces in order to provide a context of understanding the power and rhetoric of the initial inscription and reading or reception of what we now call Christian letters. The larger, more theoretical frameworks that inform my paper are twofold. That is, the larger "so what" questions that drew me to this topic are these. First, what are the contexts for the development of a Christian archive with all the context of power and origins, archon and archi, that this implies? In doing this, I'm thinking through recent historiographical conversations about the danger and the power of the archive. What's the significance of the idea that early Christian communities in Greece and Asia Minor found in their epigraphic environment a formative context for the invention of an archive? That is, if the majority of early Christian communities were of low socioeconomic status with minimal access to books and book production, as has been argued recently, and to books which were expensive, or even to sophisticated literacy, might civic epigraphic publication of such archives have been a significant source for the invention of a Christian archi? Second, this paper is also informed by one philosophical trend in the materialist turn in historiography. From Jane Bennett to Karen Barad, and especially among anthropologists of religion, we're seeing a turn to conversations about matter as agentic. Jane Bennett writes, "In this materialism, matter is not the brute stuff for our vital projects or the inorganic obverse of life, but is itself a lively actor in the world. How is this agency of matter doubled when stones speak authoritatively inscribed with the first person voice of elites? Are there possible effects of such agencies upon Christians, among others, in antiquity?" So first, early Christian letter collections. Past scholarship that has addressed the question of Paul's letter collections in particular has been mainly concerned with four issues. First, what were the original Pauline letters? How should Paul's letters be read? Then in light of Greek rhetoric and epistolary manuals, why different collections place the letters in different order, and how we should interpret Pauline letters that are pseudepigraphical, say 1st and 2nd Timothy, and should we understand them as forgeries, as devolutions from a liberatory heroic Paul, as emulations, as Christian accommodations to empire in the face of persecution. That is, scholars have been most interested in the original form of the letters and in their intention, rather than in considering their multiple iterations in antiquity as evidence of early Christian diversity and difference. With the rise of the new philology, this has, of course, changed. Taking up the question of Paul not in the first century but into the third and fourth, for example, Eric Sherbensky has looked at the editions of the Corpus Paulinum to think about the intertwining of editorial practices and hermeneutics, asking how were the collections of Paul's letters fashioned. Indeed, of course, we remember that the earliest extant copy of the majority of Paul's letters, P46, dates to the late second or the early third century CE. Some speculate that Paul himself originally collected and edited his letters, a practice that would be in keeping with Cicero and other elite males of the day. However, as Brent Nongbri puts it, there's no direct evidence that such a process took place in Paul's case. He makes no direct statement to that end. Early Christian texts themselves hint at the collecting and circulating of Christian letters. Certainly by the time of the writing of 2 Peter 3:15 to 16, Paul's letters are referred to in terms of scripture, and it's said that they are poorly understood. Colossians 4:16 contains the instruction to circulate the letter to the Laodiceans and vice versa. Polycarp's letter to the Philippians, in its mentioning of the letters that the Philippians received from Paul, suggests the existence in the early second century of a collection of Paul's letters in Smyrna. The same letter mentions that, quote, we are sending you the letters of Ignatius, which were sent to us by him, as well as other letters of his that we possess. These are attached to this letter. And we need not only look to Paul and others, we can also think about the second century CE letters of Ignatius of Antioch that indicate the power of the epistolary form and the power, in particular, of Paul's letters in crafting that epistolary identity for Ignatius. The epistolary beginning also of the Acts of the Apocalypse of John evokes the notion of the publicness of letters and their role in constructing and challenging the identity of civic ecclesiae, as well as offering sharp instructions and challenges. All these, of course, are largely addressed to cities in Greece, Macedonia, and Asia Minor. A haphazard and improvisational Christian archive was forming, the sort of archive that would appear in other archives. As we think of Roman bureaucratic lists in the time of the Great Persecution, which detailed the books, the goods, even the sandals that had been found in early Christian churches in Egypt. Both the evidence from Pauline pseudepigraphy and from the letters of Ignatius, we find the circulation of early Christian letters as a group. In addition, if the Moratorian canon dates to the second century rather than the fourth, we have there too evidence of the circulation of Paul's letters. With the new philological turn, the tide has changed, and it's time to consider the letter collections as objects and to ask about the context of formation of this Christian epistolary archive. So too, the display of letters. Amid this excellent work, most have missed the significance of epigraphic evidence for our understanding of the larger environment in which early Christian letters were composed, circulated, and published, because of the scholarly focus on the authenticity, sincerity, and original form of these letters, the missing autographs we long for. We find a sort of exception in Clouk's Ancient Letters and the New Testament, which argues that scholars of the New Testament have undervalued the significance of Hellenistic royal letters, particularly found in inscriptions, as relevant for understanding epistolography in early Christianity. He mentions as well this trend continuing into the Roman period, but Clouk himself does not expand much upon his own observations, and of the 26 examples of letters that Deismann used earlier in the century, none is an inscription, although of course he uses epigraphic evidence elsewhere in his Light from the East. One context or inspiration is, and not the only one, for the publication of early Christian letters are these civic spaces. Such letters carved on stone in the center of cities often mark the ways in which various cities of the Roman period remained in conversation with the imperial family. While Fergus Millar and Tony Honoré might debate the ways in which petitions were brought to the imperial family, as Tor Haugen recounts, it is incontrovertible that many petitions were sent to provincial governors and emperors, and that both engaged in responding, sometimes in epistolary form. So my first example comes from Aphrodisias, which has a tiny red dot on this map. You can see. Many of you have been there more often than even I. Aphrodisias boasted excellent marble quarries nearby and eventually a sculptor's school, it seems, but otherwise was not a particularly exciting town, at least in the first century BCE. Nonetheless, it gained prestige in part because of its excellent marketing plan, in which it appealed to the new situation in Rome as Octavian rose to power, connecting the Julio-Claudian family's foremother, Venus Genetrix, to their own civic goddess, Aphrodite. The situation was further cemented by an Aphrodisian-born freeman of Octavian, C. Julius Zoilus. He advocated before Octavian for the city, and the Aphrodisians erected a monument, visible here, to recognize his political influence and benefactions to their city. The archive wall at Aphrodisias stands behind the north parados of the theater scene building. While the theater itself was mostly built in the second half of the first century BCE, it was reworked in the mid to second half of the second century CE with the orchestra and stage remodeled for wild beast fights. The inscriptions on the wall thus date primarily to the second and third century CE, but much of the content of the inscriptions provides documentary evidence in the period of 41 to 38 BCE in 16 documents carved across five columns. While other publicly displayed archives are known from epigraphic evidence, and while we know from literary evidence about small-scale documents written on more perishable materials that were kept in archives in Rome and in provincial cities, the wall at Aphrodisias is a currently unparalleled as an archive of civic relations with Rome. In itself, the distance in time between the original documents, Republican, and their publication or inscription in the High Roman period, this fact is an interesting comparandum with early Christian letters, which it seems also had a gap in time between their writing and their circulation. The archive wall could be accessed from the back of the theater, and as many of you know better than I, this is the location of the archive wall, where lay a substantial agora. The wall was not originally intended as an archive, it seems. The blocks of local marble were adapted by a fine polishing of the surface over the dado, and the inscription reaches a height of circa 1.68 meters. The polishing of the surface happened piecemeal, it seems, as masons inscribed particular texts in. This has the result of a kind of bricolage. The dado is in places cut down to continue an inscription, and at other points the roughness between inscriptions reaches a high relief. The balks are, in Joyce Reynolds' words, haphazard and not decorative. But the wall is by no means messy. The lettering is careful and beautifully regular, even today, due to lightly incised guidelines and the inscriber's skill. I emphasize the physical quality of the archive wall because its appearance is relevant for our consideration of many early Christian forms of direct address, whether Paul's letters or Ignatius's or even the direct address of apologists like Justin or Athenagoras. That is the wall, quote unquote, that Christians, that is, there is a wall, quote unquote, that Christians too engage in rapid fire juxtapositions of direct address. We cannot know how or if the wall was lit or if the height of the wall made reading some inscriptions difficult. As in other discussions of epigraphic publications, given our meager knowledge of literacy in the ancient world, it's hard to know what impact such lavish inscriptions would have made on the average citizen, not to mention passerby. Perhaps it's best to understand the Aphrodisian archive wall as making three kinds of impact. First, it's a selective civic archive that is publicly available and in the second and third century CE asserts Aphrodisian links to Rome by juxtaposing various documents. Thus, second, it may have been a source of pride to the elite and highly literate citizen who could read those documents. Third, for all who lingered there, no matter their literacy level, it would have been an object known to link Aphrodisias and Rome and to confirm Aphrodisias' special status as a free and tax-exempt city. And here to give you a sense of the beauty of the archive wall. From this archive wall, let me read to you just one inscription. I want you to notice the intimacy of the letter on the one hand and its public form as broadcast on the and its form as a public broadcast on the other. This text from 39 to 38 BCE unfortunately no longer exists on the archive wall, but in fragments found in reuse in the city walls. Imperator Caesar, son of Divus Iulius, designated consul for et cetera, greetings. If you are well, it would be good. I too am in good health, together with the army. Solon, son of Demetrius, your ambassador, who has taken the greatest care over the business of your city, has not only been satisfied by the administrative arrangements that have been made, but has also urged us to send to you from the public records these copies of the edict, the senatus consultum, the treaty, and the law that relates to you. For this I praised him, approved him the more, held him as one of my acquaintances, and gave him the appropriate privileges, thinking him deserving of honor from us. And I congratulate you on the possession of such a citizen. The copies of the privileges that relate to you are these that are subjoined. I wish you to register them among your public records. Note the epistolary conventions and direct address of the document, probably written by Octavian and with references to his well-being and that of the army, a convention that dates as early as 117 BCE. Solon is referred to as presbytos, an ambassador. The letter inscribed on the wall is enmeshed in documentary exchange. That is, it references other documents, just as Paul's letters sometimes indicate an earlier exchange. Or a later Christian writer like Justin in his Apology asks readers to turn to a Hadrianic rescript. My second example comes from Athens. While the archive wall in Aphrodisias is unusual in its state of preservation, the practice of imperial publication and a direct address is not. To give another example, fragments of an inscription discovered from the 1930s to the 1960s in Athens and associated with the Roman Forum there teach us something about imperial communications with cities, imperial involvement in their affairs, and the display of communication. Put together, these fragments reveal a communication from the Emperor Hadrian to the Athenians. As Clauk noted with regard to the Hellenistic royal inscriptions, part of the interest in such a letter lies in the fact that not an individual but a group is addressed. Just as Paul and his co-writers or other early Christian letters address an ecclesia in the majority of these letters, so too in this letter we find a community publicly addressed. The inscription is a series of communications dealing with cases at Athens. The portion of it that we discuss was found in reuse as a paver in the Roman Agora. As James Oliver puts it, the first 56 lines of Plaque 2 concern appeals to the emperor either by defendants or plaintiffs. A range of situations is discussed. Three are characteristic. The first has to do with cult officials and finances, treating torchbearers and voluntary priests who should prepay, quote, the food honorarium of the priesthood, according to the law. The second has to do with the Areopagites, a body likely involved in juridical decisions. Hadrian's concern that because those of freed person descent and others of low status are gaining membership among the Areopagites. Third, Hadrian's concern with the relation between the Athenians and their wealthy citizen Herodias Atticus, and Athenian anger at Herodias for stiffing them out of the inheritance that his father had left to the city. Yet this document is not an edict per se, but an epistle. Marcus Aurelius himself calls it an epistula, metatin epistulin emin eteran, and also uses the word grammata. He uses a second person form of address. The section on the Areopagites gives a sense of the tone of imperial involvement and direct address, and I quote, "How much interest I take in protecting the reputation of Athens so that she remain in possession of her ancient dignity has been made sufficiently clear, I think, and particularly so when I tried to lead the city's own select synhedrion back to the ancient custom." What is the significance of this epistula in stone for a study of the attack of Paul's letters? In tandem with the archive wall at Aphrodisias, it allows us to see a larger context in which early Christian letters are collected and published in civic centers. It allows us to see a cultural context in which letters in general are collected and published in civic centers available to the literate. Such inscriptions publish and proclaim the fact that emperors were involved in local problems and, when requested, intervened most frequently in cases where the public interest seemed to be involved, even if the appellants did not themselves have Roman citizenship. For civic elites, such an inscription allows links to be woven and strengthened between their cities and the emperors. For the emperors, this allows for public display of beneficence, concern, and presence in various cities of the empire. My third example, and I was so naive when I wrote this talk, I forgot that Stephen Mitchell, Cedric Prélaz, other epigraphists would be here. My third example comes from Oinoanda. From what I've presented so far, one might think that the phenomenon of publicly displayed archives and publicly displayed letters in particular is limited to documents associated with the politics of the late Roman Republic or the Roman imperial family, but this is not the case. The idea of the city as producing publicly visible archives, which include letters, is made more complex by an inscription in Oinoanda. Oinoanda, as some of you know very, very well, is the location of stunning inscriptions. The famous inscription first published by George Ewart Bean and more recently used by Stephen Mitchell to discuss the idea of theohipsosis and pagan monotheism in antiquity. It also boasts the Demosthenia inscription of circa 124 CE. But it's not this Hadrianic letter in the Demosthenia inscription that I want to focus on. Rather, beginning in the late 19th century, fragments of another very long inscription began to be identified in the area of Oinoanda. And the fragments of this, and these dots indicate the frequency of fragment finds, indicate a roughly 80-meter long inscription located in the area called the Esplanade, a flat polygonal space that likely held the agora until the late Hadrianic or Antonine periods. The inscription was likely located in the South Stoa. The long inscription was carved at the behest of one Diogenes, and according to recent arguments in the latest critical edition by Martin Smith, likely dates to the 120 CE. "I wish to use this stoa," Diogenes wrote, "to advertise publicly the medicines that bring salvation." For Diogenes, these are the teachings of Epicurus. He states that if there were only one or even six people who had this particular problem, he would choose a different means of propagating his ideas. However, because the majority, quote, "suffer from a common disease as in a plague with false notions about things, and their number is increasing," he offers a public health announcement through the philosophical inscription, quote, "since the remedies of the inscription will reach a larger number of people. I say these things," he writes through the inscription, "just as if I were taking action, and in an endeavor to prove what befits our nature, namely freedom from disturbance, is identical for one and for all." The wall contains various works by Epicurus in the form of Diogenes' epitomes, but also forms of direct address, like those just mentioned, as well as letters. And Judith Liu has commented on the ways in which philosophical texts and the practices of letter writing are related by the dialogical nature of both. Diogenes is an interesting example of both. At least one of the letters that Diogenes has inscribed are, to my ears, oddly mundane. Addressed to Antipater from Rhodes, Diogenes' letter mentions meeting Antipater and other friends in Athens and elsewhere and talks of voyages and plans to sail. Both these fragments and others publicize the personal details of travel and the hopes of visit, details that remind us of similar scraps of information in the letters of Paul and other early Christian letters, such as in 2 Timothy 4:13, "when you come, bring the cloak that I left with Carpus at Troas, and also the books and above all the parchments." These details, in the case of Diogenes and pseudo-Paul, are juxtaposed with philosophical persuasion, if of different sorts. Diogenes says, for instance, "I'm sending you, in accordance with your request, the argument concerning an infinite number of worlds," presaging the work of philosopher David Lewis, if you will. He goes on to recount how face-to-face dialogue with a novice teacher rendered Diogenes' own understanding sharper and offers that he appends the subsequent dialogue for Antipater so that you may be in the same position as if you yourself were present. And I give an inscription example of the Great Wall seen from the south, and then an inscription, the letter to his mother. Such inscribed letters place the literate passerby of the inscription in the role of Antipater, or in the case of this inscription, Diogenes' own mother, receiving such a letter and invited to engage thoughtfully in its dialogue, now a trialogue, as Diogenes had argued, a communication to an entire population. The fiction of the single recipient draws in the reader and then leads him or her on to a reading of the dialogue which, though now fragmentary, followed letters such as these. In addition, the very layout of the inscription is bookish, introducing the passerby to book culture, as well as asking him or her to enter into an archive of knowledge. We don't know if this was published as a book afterwards. There must have been at least one written copy for the stonemason. And I quote now from Martin Smith, "each section of Diogenes' inscription was presented like an unrolled papyrus, the imitation of the contemporary book being manifested in the arrangement of the text in columns, in the length of the lines, in the rules of syllable division followed, and in the methods of punctuation employed. Scholarly study of early Christian writing and collections must investigate the intersection of early Christian letter production with epigraphic evidence and with writing and book culture more generally in antiquity, with a particular view to understanding the power and authority manifested by such elite inscriptions on the one hand, and the possibility that one's attention might be arrested by a voice speaking from stone on the other. To conclude, in this paper, I've argued that the epigraphic publication of letters in the spaces of cities that early Christians inhabited is a context in which to understand early Christian practices of collecting and publishing letters and receiving letter collections. Indeed, a cultural context in which publication of books and books themselves were very expensive, we can imagine that the archive walls of cities were more likely to be the context for letter publications that early Christians, likely at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, saw the most frequently. They're a critical source for the articulation of their identity. This culture of epigraphic direct address, we might expect, controverts our modern categories of the private and public. So too, letters those like those of Paul or written in Paul's voice, or the powerful letters written to the angels of the Ecclesia of Asia Minor found in the Apocalypse of John, are collective calls in the civic context of Ecclesia discourse still vibrant in Greek cities under the Roman Empire. We need not divide the world, as Deisman did, into epistles and letters, the former rhetorically crafted, high literature, the latter intimate and authentic. We should recognize that Coates's address to his son, Baldwin's to his nephew, both are and are not addressed to those small audiences. Early Christian letters, similarly, to cite a line from Martha Ronk's poem, were attentive to when the building speaks and may have imitated those forms. Thank you.